Save big on your next painting project at Menards. Pristine Exterior is Dutch Boy's most durable exterior paint. With its Rain Rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Ladies and gentlemen, put on your tap shoes and grab your umbrellas. Welcome to another dazzling episode of Silver Screen Cinema Classics podcast, where we take a deep dive into Hollywood's golden era. Today, at least, we are splashing into the timeless classic Singing in the Rain, a movie so joyous even Gene Kelly couldn't help but twirl around lampposts. We did have a guest planned for this episode. You have heard him on our previous Willy Wonka episode, a guest called Jeremy. He's a huge fan of musical theatre and this movie in particular, but unfortunately he had a bit of a medical emergency and wasn't able to make it. Presumably, well, hopefully he wasn't, overdoing the old song and dance or physical comedy routines. But in any case, we're sorry you couldn't make it, Jeremy, and obviously, we're hoping for a speedy recovery from whatever it is that ails you, and hopefully we'll have you on another time. So, listener/viewer, if you are with us, fear not, we are here. The originals, you might say, the hosts. It's just myself, Mike, your usual host, joined by my usual co-host, DK. Welcome.
Gotta dance!
Yes, I guess we are technically the Don and Cosmo of the podcast.
Yeah. So dignity. Always dignity.
Oh, I couldn't be less sure of this podcast, let's be fair. Anyway, join us, guest, as we navigate the stormy transition from silent films to talkies, break down the unforgettable song and dance routines, and maybe even discover what really happened to Lena Lamont's voice.
Can't stand him.
So whether you're a diehard fan of Don Lockwood or you just enjoy a good downpour, tune in because we're about to make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh. Hopefully with us, not at us. So...
That shit sailed long, long ago, dude.
Woo! Anyway, so, yes, this week, as I say, this is the Cinema Classics podcast. And this month, I should say, we are looking at more of a classic. Again, we've dealt with more modern ones. And we're going back to the 1950s this time to look at classic musical Singing in the Rain. Before we jump into the BTS section, I just wanted to get a couple of things out of the way. First of all, I want it to be known, because I've kept it to myself and tried to keep shtum, that this is the first time I've ever seen this movie. So what you'll be getting from me is first impressions. So if I sound a little bit less knowledgeable than perhaps I usually would, I'd never seen this until I decided to do it for the podcast. So, so that was my first impression of this movie, was a few days ago. And since I always ask, whoever else is here, DK, what were your first impressions and when was the first time you saw Singing in the Rain?
Oh, I saw this years ago. I must have been 4 or 5 and my parents had it on TV. I don't really remember much of it. It's not something I've watched regularly because I'm, evidence to the contrary, I'm not a big musicals person. And yeah, this was the first time I'd seen this in a while. So it brought back a lot of memories, not just for the movie itself, but from when I saw it as a young kid.
Well, fair enough. See, I grew up watching a lot of musicals because my mum is a huge musicals fan. But it's like some of the weirdest blind spots that she has, like this and The Sound of Music, that she didn't watch. And yet I've seen really weird stuff like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and The King and I and, you know, the really obscure Rodgers and Hammerstein ones that you wouldn't think of. But, yeah, things like this have passed me by. And you did ask offline what it was that made me decide, therefore, to do this on the podcast. So I'll let you know now. The reason for it was because I recently watched, well, I say recently, when it was out, I watched the movie Babylon, the Damien Chazelle movie, and quite enjoyed it. But that movie also deals with the kind of transition from silent films to talkies and that whole era. And Singing in the Rain comes up in that movie. And when it came up, you know, at that time when I was watching the film, I was like, I really should see that film. It's got a very good reputation and it's clearly kind of integral to, you know, Hollywood history. Plus, I love movies about movies, which is sort of a shameful thing to admit sometimes, perhaps. But those tend to be the ones that win awards, you know. So I was like, I've got a feeling I'll enjoy this because, I like musicals. I like films that are about the making of films and Hollywood history. And especially, you know, that era when films were still this kind of magical, I guess, thing and kind of new thing. And film stars were huge and... Yeah, so, but I mean, we'll get into that when we talk about the movie. So that was the initial reason that I wanted to kind of cover this on the podcast. One of the other reasons I'll get into a little bit later, because I have it written down to end my kind of behind the scenes part of the story. So, yeah, before we get into, you know, anything else more specific and deal with, you know, our little review of the movie, what we thought of it, favorite bits, etc., we do always do a behind the scenes section, and that often usually falls under the purview of DK. So, DK, I left it up to you to kind of explain, since, as I said, this is the first time I've seen this, how this movie kind of came about, how it got made, and where it originated from. So, do you want to take it away and start our back behind the scenes section, sir?
Yeah, sure. It's obviously it's highly popular musical. It's 1952 is when it was released. It's an American musical romantic comedy directed and choreographed by Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen. It stars Kelly, Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds. It's a light-hearted depiction of Hollywood in the late 20s, with the three stars portraying performers caught up in the transition from silent films to talkies. Now, Arthur Freed, the head of the Freed unit over at MGM, he was responsible for the studio's musicals. He conceived the idea of a movie based on the back catalogue of songs written by himself and Nacio Herb Brown, and he called in Betty Comden and Adolph Green from New York to come up with a story to tie the songs together and write the script. Because many of the songs had originally been written during the time when silent films were giving way to talkies and musicals were popular with audiences, Comden and Green came up with the idea that the story itself should be set during that transitional period in Hollywood, an era they were both intimately familiar with. When Howard Keel was mentioned as the possible lead, they tried to work up a story involving a star of Western movies who makes a comeback as a singing cowboy. But they kept gravitating to a story about a swashbuckling romantic hero with a vaudeville background who survives the transition by falling back on his abilities as a song and dance man, a story which Gene Kelly was well suited for. The movie premiered on March 27th, 1952 at the Radio City Music Hall, New York, and won O'Connor the Golden Globe Award for Best Actor in a motion picture musical or comedy, and Betty Comden and Adolph Green won their Writers Guild of America Award for their screenplay, while Gene Hagen was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. Despite this, the film was only a modest hit when it was first released, being only the 10th highest grossing movie of that year in the US and Canada. However, it's since been accorded legendary status by contemporary critics and is often regarded as the greatest musical movie ever made and one of the greatest films ever made, as well as the greatest film made in the aforementioned Freed unit at MGM. It topped the AFI's Greatest Movie Musicals list, and it's ranked as the fifth greatest American motion picture of all time in its updated list of the greatest American films in 2007. In 1989, Singing in the Rain was one of the first 25 films selected by the United States Library of Congress
for preservation in the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically or aesthetically significant. And in 2005, the British Film Institute included it in its list of the 50 films to be seen by the age of 14. So you messed that up, Mike. In 2008, Empire magazine ranked it as the 8th best film of all time. And in Sight and Sound magazine's 2022 list of the greatest films of all time, Singing in the Rain placed in the 10th position.
Awesome. So I have a little bit just to finish us off then, just random facts about the making of the movie and stuff. First of all, in the sequence in which Gene Kelly dances and sings the title song while spinning an umbrella, splashing through puddles and getting soaked with rain, Kelly was actually sick with a 130 degree Fahrenheit or 39 degrees Celsius fever. The water used in the scene caused Kelly's wool suit to shrink during filming. A common myth is that Kelly managed to perform the entire song in one take, thanks to cameras being placed at predetermined locations. However, this is not the case. Filming the sequence took 2 to 3 days. Another myth is that the rain was mixed with milk in order for the drops to show up better on camera, but the desired visual effect was actually produced, albeit with difficulty, just through backlighting. So, yeah. Most of the costumes from the film were eventually acquired by Debbie Reynolds and held in her massive collection of original film costumes, sets and props. Many of these items were sold at a 2011 auction in Hollywood. While most items were sold to, obviously, private collectors, Donald O'Connor's green check fit as a fiddle suit and shoes were purchased by Costume World Inc. and they are now on permanent display at the Costume World Broadway Collection Museum in Pompano Beach, Florida. So if you get a chance and you happen to be in America or near there, go have a look and tell them that the Silver Screen Podcast sent you. This is an insane fact here. The film's network television premiere was postponed by 2 weeks due to the assassination of President Kennedy and its aftermath. It was originally scheduled for a date that will be familiar to all fellow geeks, November the 23rd, 1963.
Wonder what could have happened then.
If you're not quite as nerdy-minded as us, this is actually the air date of the very first episode of Doctor Who. So, very weird coincidence there. According to the audio commentary on the 2002 Special Edition DVD, the original negative was destroyed in a fire. Despite this, the film was digitally restored for its DVD release. A Blu-ray Ultimate Collector's Edition was released in July 2012, and a 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray was released on April 26th, 2022. The digital version of the film is currently available to stream if you're in the US on HBO Max, but it is not currently streaming anywhere in the UK. And I will say, if you're playing our usual drinking game, yes, I did watch this in 4K Ultra HD. So that was the other reason that I wanted to watch this, was because I'm sure I've mentioned it before, but I bought a box set of Warner Brothers Golden Age Classics.
It was in that one?
It's in that collection, and I will say, I'm going to leave a link in the description. Not that I'll get I won't get any commission or anything for it, but I've seen this thing is reduced now to around £30 pretty much everywhere, and it's 4K and Blu-ray of Singing in the Rain, The Wizard of Oz, Casablanca, Rebel Without a Cause, and I knew I was going to forget one of them.
Hold on. Casablanca, Rebel Without a Cause, Singing in the Rain. We're just doing this show so you can promote your 4K.
We're doing it so I have an excuse to watch the films on there.
It's just like, I've bought a 4K player and damn it, I'm going to get some use out of this.
Look, if I don't do this, I won't bring myself to watch these classic films that I've never otherwise seen. But as I say, not that I'm getting any commission or anything for it, I just think if you happen to be into films in the way that I am, £30 for 5 movies that classic on both 4K and Blu-ray is a stone cold bargain. So
I'm actually tempted myself for that one.
Yeah, it's pretty much everywhere for like £30. Some places a little bit less, some a little bit more, but I mean, on average, around £30. And it started off as 50, which still wasn't too bad, but yeah, anyway. So yes, if you're wondering what other films we might be doing at some point on the Cinema Classics collection.
I'm sure Citizen Kane's going to be there, just a hunch.
Citizen Kane, Wizard of Oz, I mean, they're both on that set.
I might not be there for Citizen Kane. I'll be sat watching Ghostbusters somewhere.
You are right, though. It is weird how we've covered 3 out of those 5 on here already.
Yeah.
What a bizarre coincidence. Anyway, so yeah, I did kind of want to, like I said, watch it because I'm not that just because I happened to have it on the 4K and that way I could get to it. But like I said, I was intrigued by the movie Babylon, which again brings me to the first thing that I've got for the writing and the plot. Before I get into that, I will let you know if you happen to be a new viewer or you're unsure of how we do things. We break down our notes just into little sections like writing and plot, directing, acting, special effects, visual effects, you know, things like that, music and sound. We don't stick rigidly to it if, you know, the conversation flows one way or another, but it's just our way of organizing notes because we don't want to do what a lot of these podcasts do and just have a boring kind of scene-by-scene breakdown of the movie. We are kind of under the assumption that if you're listening to this, you've seen the movie. You know, hopefully, go watch it. Don't let, you know, let somebody talk to you through it and on a podcast. So, mate, go and watch it and enjoy it. It's a visual feast.
Yeah, so, don't be like Mike.
Hey, man, I watched it. How dare you? So, yeah, I was just going to say then, with regards to the writing and the plot, 70 years after Singing in the Rain was made, Babylon in 2022 would also look, as I said, at the tumultuous changeover to talking pictures, including the unique problems suffered by Lena Lamont in the diction department. Be very careful how you say that. In that movie, after the success of The Jazz Singer in 1927, actor Jack Conrad, Brad Pitt, also had a problem with his career because of his voice. Also similar is how the studio tries to correct Nellie LeRoy or Margot Robbie's lower class speaking with the help of Mildred Yates, Jennifer Grant. Similarities are not accidental, as the song Singing in the Rain is featured in Babylon, and the movie ends with protagonist Manny Torres going to see Singing in the Rain by himself and being moved to tears. So I didn't have that reaction when I first watched it, but yeah, so there we go. And yeah, what can I say? If you're a fan of these kinds of things, I do recommend Babylon, but it's very different to Singing in the Rain. It's not for the faint of heart. There's an awful lot of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll type stuff in there. And it's not a fantastic movie, but...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
As I say, if you're interested in the kind of the classic Hollywood era, the transition between silent films, talkies, that kind of thing, it's worth a watch, I would say. So, yeah. Moving on from that, because we're not reviewing that one. That was basically all I had. Did you have anything that you wanted to mention quickly before we start talking about our own notes on the writing and the plot, DK?
No, that's all I have, man.
Cool. Well, as I say, since we are talking about that then, what do you think about the writing and the plot overall, the structure the way it is, and do you have a favourite sort of aspect of the writing or a thing that stands out?
I love this. I'm going to come straight out of the gate. I love this. I think it's an absolute joy to watch, and I think that's very much down to the writing, the briskness of the plot that goes from A to B. It does, with the exception of maybe one scene, which I'll come to later. Mm. It goes through at a breakneck speed, and the dialogue is beautiful. The characters likable, even the ones that maybe aren't necessarily supposed to be likable, and I honestly can't fault it. I just love this thing. I think it's really well done, and it's just got some great lines. And as you know, I guess we'll get to the songs as they are, mm-hmm. but you know, even the songs, just iconic. There's a reason that so many of them are iconic, and I just think it's done really well. Obviously, it's there to showcase, you know, Mr. Kelly, and it does it to a really good extent. I did read that certain sections were going to be different, but Kelly had them written to feature just himself. I can't really blame him. It's, you know, what we've ended up with is iconic. And yeah, I honestly, at the risk of, you know, coming across as a Gene Kelly hater, which I'm not, it's obviously very much favoured towards him. But I still think it gives Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds a real chance to shine. And I just,
I'll talk a little bit to that when we get to the acting, because I do have a little bit about the kind of the way that certainly that Mr. Kelly interacted with his co-stars and things like that, which wasn't always the best, But at least I think he has since many times at least apologized and kind of acknowledged that fact. And, you know how geniuses often are, perfectionists to geniuses.
He was not very much a perfectionist.
Yeah. I'll mention that, like I said, when we get to the acting. But it's strange that you say, in terms of, like, the overall writing and plot, that there's one thing that you think stands out as not being especially as good or not keeping up with the pace. Because I made exactly the same note without knowing that you were going to say that, and I'm curious if it's the same thing.
When we get to it, we'll see.
Yeah. Fair enough. I won't mention it then just yet, because I agree with you. I think a lot of the plot, with one exception, is really, like you said, it's paced fantastically well. It does everything it needs to. The musical numbers seem to come in exactly when they're most necessary. They don't, just land with a thud. They come in seemingly naturally, and they're all enjoyable. But more importantly, if it was just, musical numbers and you're waiting for the next one, it would be a very much, old style Broadway review type movie, and it's not that. You've got to give, I think, credit, having just watched it obviously, to the fact that all the bits in between the song and dance routines are also really funny, really charming, and really well acted, and it's a great movie as well as a great series of songs and dances. And like I said, a lot of the time when it comes to these movie musicals, you don't feel like the people that are writing it felt they had to do that. You just feel like it was like, well, we've got a bunch of songs and stuff. I guess we'll have to write some kind of thread to link us to the next song, and it doesn't matter what it's like, kind of thing. And this, I was like, no, I'm still hooked in even between the songs. I'm still loving the cheeky bits of humor and things that you're doing, the like I said, the performances and everything. And I can't really say, with, like I said, one perhaps exception, I can't really fault a lot of what was done here. And I was pleasantly surprised that it wasn't, there was no boredom. There was no, I guess we'll wait for the next thing or whatever. Yeah. It flowed quite nicely.
I'll be honest with you. When you say, oh, we're going to do a musical, my heart drops. If it's, if it's not something that I'm familiar with, like Little Shop or Labyrinth or something like that, I just think, oh, God. Because my experience, especially with, and don't hate me, musical fans, don't get your torches and pitchforks ready. When it comes to from this era, obviously musicals were the, the in thing. But a lot of them really don't hold up that well. To modernize. And when you said, oh, what, we're doing a musical, and you said it's Singing in the Rain, and as I say, I watched it since, back when I was a child, can't really remember much of it, and I just thought, oh, God, this is going to drag, apart from the songs that I know. And it didn't. There's, obviously that one scene, but for everything else, it seemed to be over in a flash, because it was just so enjoyable. As you say, it wasn't just a musical. It felt like a movie. And you could literally take the songs out of this, and you'd still have an it would only last like an hour at most, but it would still be an entertaining hour. You could sit back and you think, I'm going to watch that because there's some really cracking dialogue, some great performances, and it is really entertaining. None of the bits, as you say, in between the song feels like filler. And I think when you look back at a lot of musicals, you do get that impression. But this, it just moves along, and it's just really well done. Really well done.
Yeah. But I did want to emphasize that, like I said, kind of to what you were saying, you could take some of the songs and stuff out. I want to emphasize the fact that if you are kind of a bit wary of musicals, especially if, a lot of people I know are very, it's going to be the traditional love story type thing. And there is that in Singing in the Rain, don't get me wrong. But it also functions equally as well, if not better, as a comedy for me. Yeah. which, again, I wasn't really expecting it to be, especially a comedy that genuinely made me, made me laugh. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Because they say humour doesn't age very well. But there were times in this that I really was laughing. It holds up incredibly well.
Yeah. I mean, from the very beginning, like I said, you opened the film, and I knew from the start, I was like, I feel like I'm going to enjoy this, because it's not taking itself seriously. It's a little bit cheeky. And the way it opens with, like, everyone's waiting for Don Lockwood, and the crowd are all cheering until they realize it's not him, and then they all sit back down again.
Yeah.
And then, Gene Kelly, steps up and breaks the fourth wall immediately, staring directly at the camera, which is breaking like the cardinal rule. And I was like, right, this film doesn't give a crap. I'm here.
And then he literally just comes up and just offloads all this bullshit on everyone. And you're just saying, yeah, I mean, this is great. I'm straight in here. This is my kind of film.
It's such obvious comedy, and I don't know why it works, as you said, considering that some comedy doesn't age. But there's something beautiful about the fact that he's describing, like you said, this dignified, great, glorious life, and we're seeing the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So it's like the visuals are basically going, you're bullshitting, man. Yeah. It's really funny.
I do like that.
Himself when he's like, we found ourselves stranded. I mean, staying.
and again, like I said earlier, dignity, always dignity. And it's, you know, and it's him and Cosmo getting pulled off the stage by crooks.
I mean, I've written it all down because there's some, I mean, they're all great. Like, oh, I was educated with the classics, the great poets. And he's away to see like a pulp Doc Savage movie. He's like, and of course we were adored. And then the entire crowd that you're seeing are booing them off.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, I love it.
There are some, you know, proper dad jokes in this. You know, Cosmo, call me a cab. Okay, you're a cab.
I love that cab.
Yeah, but it's... I think what helps is the... I mean, we'll get to it, obviously. The delivery. These two people are so endearing. They're so likeable. Yeah. You don't... You know, if he came up and he was smarmy and... You know, he started offloading this bullshit like, your certain politicians, then you wouldn't be on his side. But they're so personable as a team. Because I'll be honest with you, when we started watching it this time, I thought, is Cosmo going to get done dirty here at some point? But it never comes across like that. They always, there's never a lull where they don't seem like this really good team. And I like that.
Oh, no, completely. And that was one of the more pleasant surprises for me, not knowing what to expect, was that, as you say, Donald O'Connor is the comedy sniper of the film, where sometimes he plays it up to actually, you know, you are supposed to be specifically paying attention to him. And sometimes he just steals things with, like you said, a little, whether it be a really bad dad joke or like little things like when he's like, oh, the car's broken down. I don't understand it. This thing's worked fine for like 6 hours.
I will say. That is my favourite line in the whole film, because that is how I feel on a daily basis with my technology and everything else. So when he said it, I was just guffawing, and yes, I love that. That is pretty, my life summed up in one sentence.
Yeah, and it doesn't highlight it. The film doesn't stop and be like, but on boom, I'll give you a chance to. It's just there in the background, and you can hear it, and you can laugh at it. But the film doesn't stop for applause or anything in the way that it does after, like you said, the more obvious, like, okay, you're a cab. Oh, gee, thanks. Which is still funny. I mean,
it's just rapid fire, and they don't, as you say, they don't dwell on it and say, look, we made a funny. They just get onto that, and I love it. I just love it.
It's great. And like I said, I mean, you say two, I say more than that. I say all of the people involved are doing a fantastic job. So you're talking Gene Kelly, obviously Donald O'Connor, Debbie Reynolds, and I forget her name, Jean something, who played Lena Lamont. Really Jean. Good. You can see why she was up for awards for supporting actress.
Yeah, Jean Hagen.
Hagen. I knew it was, I almost said Hager or Harger or something, but yeah. Gene Hagen, really good, and again, quite a pleasant surprise, because I've never really even heard of her, bless, because I guess I have huge gaps in my classic Hollywood, knowledge, because I have read in the couple of days that I've watched the movie, I've read about her, and I've heard that she was in big films, but never hugely as, like, the lead role and stuff. It's worth pointing out, like I said, I thought... Especially when it started off, like I said, you had all of that comedy business and stuff, but then it settles into the telling of the story, and it's, you know, they're filming a movie, and it's how Don initially got the stunt gig, and I was like, this is very heightened, and I can see it potentially putting some people off. So I will say that as a disclaimer, if you do end up watching it and thinking, this is ridiculous, they're all over the top and overacting. But again, I think it fits for what this is, and it's just perfect. I was completely on board with it. Because it is, it's supposed to be like that. It's like, as the film kind of goes on to say, it's kind of more of a vaudeville type act. It's not supposed to be a slice of reality. It is heightened. And once you know that, you kind of just accept everything else, I guess, that comes.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, it is kind of meta in that you're watching them and they're watching a movie, you know, when they go in for the test screening and stuff like that, and you've got the, you know, the studio head. Again, that's another one. Says, you know, is this your studio or not? This is my studio. Just don't tell Lena.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Little bits of business. Yeah, just but even like it's such a kind of sly gag. But the fact that you have the Broadway review thing that goes on forever, as Kelly supposedly is describing, that's going to be part of the film within a film. So we've seen it all in front of us, and then it cuts straight back, and the studio head goes, "I can't visualize it." Like, that's such a cheeky joke because we've just literally seen it visualized. Yeah. And I'm like, that is the kind of thing that you would never, to have the confidence to make that joke and not be like, again, but I'm bumps, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just like, that is quite clever.
And it's not just the dialogue, it's in the performances, the comedy is in the performances as well. Like at the end where, you know, the cop sidles up to Gene Kelly just after he's finished the singing in the rain routine, and Gene Kelly's, you know, performance in that, and, you know, kind of being apologetic to the cop. Really, so well done.
I found that so weird and kind of amusing in a way that I probably shouldn't, because I was just like, yeah, don't try that. If you happen to be like drunk or whatever and just dancing and kicking about, don't stand in front of a cop and then just go, I'm dancing. Because
yeah.
They're not going to be happy with that response.
No.
but yes, like I said, it's Hollywood. It's, you've heightened and you've got to go with it, I think. But like you said, the performances, little things like when you're introduced to Lena Lamont and she's initially very dismissive of the lead because he's a stuntman, you know?
Oh, yeah, and then they make him the lead and she's like, you know, what are you doing tonight?
But I love that, because, again, it's not the sort of thing that you really get in those older type movies. I love the way he's like, what are you doing tonight? Nothing? Too bad. I'm busy.
Yeah.
Oh, you got it. But, and like I said, that character as, you know, it's perhaps a bit sexist by modern eyes, but it's still kind of a kind of character you wouldn't see, the idea that the leading man and the leading lady just didn't get on. And yeah, they had this for the publicity, again, very ahead of its time, you know, this fake relationship because we've got to publicize you two. But the humor you get from that they actually hate each other, there's that whole scene, I think toward the middle or nearer the end of the film where they're filming and they know it's for silent movies, so nothing they say is going to be picked up. And they're just basically berating each other as they're like kissing each other and up the arm and stuff. Like, oh, I hate you even more. Oh, it's not you.
Yeah. But one of the...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Funniest things for me was the performance of Gene Hagen in that, where they're trying to get her to record and the microphone's in the bush. And... And then they end up, and she's turning her head. It's going, yeah.
That is so weird, because that is the one scene that I recognised as being, shall we say, homage, to be kind, in Babylon, because they do almost the same thing, where Margot Robbie's character is playing like, she's a young woman who's going off to college for the first time, and she's entering her college dorm room. And they've never done sound movies before. And obviously this thing is wood paneling and stuff on the studio set. And they just can't get it, because every time she's supposed to be delivering her lines, she's just like, thud, thud, thud on the wooden floor. And then just like, oh my God, we can't hear a bloody thing. What are we going to do? You're going to have to talk louder and doing all this thing, like in Singing in the Rain, where it's like, we'll put a microphone here, we'll put it here, we'll put one on there and everything, and just don't move. And then she's supposed to answer the phone at one point during this scene, and they can't actually get that because she's so wired up, she can't get the other phone.
Yeah.
And when they pick it up, that just interferes with everything. So it's just like, it's the kind of thing you don't think of, as like, there would have been a period between silent and talkies where yeah, these are things that would have had to think about.
Exactly. You know? Well, like when they go to the test screening and you can hear the thud, thud, thud as they're walking down the stairs and she's playing with her pearls and it's making that god-awful racket. But and he throws his cane and, just, and you can hear it just clanking to the floor in the background.
Oh, when she slaps him with a newspaper and he says something like, what did you hit him with, a brick or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love it. Because like I said, it's just that kind of thing is, it's not there for the show, you know, songy and dancey parts, but it's just fun.
Yes.
And that, it's to do with something that interests me anyway. So, yeah. As I'm going through my notes here, I have a couple of more lines that I wanted to shout out. First of all, the studio's got to keep their stars from looking ridiculous. Nobody has that much money. And another of my favorites, also from Cosmo, because like I said, he is the comedy sniper, when he just jumps in and goes, why, she's irresistible, don't you know? She told me so herself.
Yeah. I like the old, she can't act, she can't sing, she can't dance. A triple threat.
Yeah, I mean, even the kind of the traditional meet cute when, like, he has to escape his adoring fans and jumps into Debbie Reynolds' car. She's initially like, get out, mister. It's kind of, it's fun. It's a nice little way of doing these things, even if it is very kind of cliche.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I will say I initially very much didn't like her character because, yeah, dismissive of movie stars in movies. I wasn't having that. So I was with Gene Kelly on that one. But again, I love the way that instead of him, you know, being vicious or whatever about it, the way that he teases her with that, like, oh, look, it's Ethel Barrymore dragging yourself down to our level or whatever. It's just like, oh, I love it. It's cool. Yeah, you've kind of mentioned the rest of the bit of physical comedy with the, you know, the microphone and the bush and everything and trying to, yeah. But like I said, the idea of, because I'm well aware that there's been like dubbing of people's voices since talkies began as well. So the idea behind that and like dramatizing in a kind of amusing way how that might have happened, but also keeping that interesting in regards to, you know, the having Lena as the bad guy who wants us to, you know, keep her fame and utilize, you know, I guess in a Little Mermaid kind of way, steal Debbie Reynolds' voice.
Yeah.
You know, you've got her being like, and the boys that are like, no, she deserves credit. Dang it, let's get out of here. So,
I love the going back to Cosmo. That another one that's came into my head. Talking pictures. That means I'm out of a job. At least I can start suffering and write that symphony. And RF says, "You're not out of a job. We're putting you as head of our new music department." And Cosmo says, "Oh, thanks, RF. At last, I can stop suffering and write that symphony."
It's great. He's amazing. Oh, I love it. And I mean, it's not really to do with the writing. It's more direction and general stuff. But the whole make 'em laugh sequence, I adored that so much. I was just like, yes, it kind of, I could see people that might complain that it stops the film in terms of what it's supposed to be doing and everything, but it's just so good. And yes. I'm so here for that kind of old-fashioned physical comedy and pratfalls and the rubber-faced, the nature of what Donald O'Connor's doing there and what he's putting himself through is just like, and I genuinely did laugh.
Yeah.
I was like, this is brilliant.
I don't know if it was just my mind playing tricks, but I expected that much later in the film. But it's like the first 15, 20 minutes.
Mm. Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's really early on, and it's so good. Where he sat there on the couch with the dummy.
Yeah. All of it. I mean, the cartwheel over the wall, the Homer Simpson, like, running on the floor kind of thing.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I had no idea that was a reference to Saved at the Rim when I first watched The Simpsons. And now I'm just like, oh, that's what that was. You know what I mean. They're running around in a circle, but he's actually on the floor kind of thing. But like I said, the busting through the wall, doing the kind of, oh, my face is out of shape, I'm pushing it back into place kind of thing. And
yeah,
it's just, it's incredible. Like I said, you've got to give kudos because, like I said, I've said it before, I'm sure, on this podcast, but, you know, everyone always says dying's easy, comedy's hard. And if you're pulling off the drama and the romance and everything, fair play, but pulling off the comedy, That's work, that's effort. You
know? They make it look, and this is what I like, they make it, all of them, they make it look so effortless in this.
Oh, yeah.
That it's definitely. Just, you know, and I don't know if it's part of that, but the tone, right from the start, they don't have a symphony that, you know, they don't have an overture that brings it in like some of the other musicals. It's just those three in raincoats, smiling,
yep,
and singing and dancing, and it kind of sets the tone all the way through, and I like that. It's so, I don't know, it's so endearing. You find yourself sucked in and liking these people before you've even met them in a narrative sense. And I think it does it really well.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, you grow this. I struggle to find a better word, but you grow just so charmed by the people, the movie, the characters. Even like I said, you find yourself not quite hating Lena. You find, you know, she's I guess the kind of you love to hate character, but she's just fun to watch.
Yes.
And even then, she's not so much of a threat because she's so unbelievably stupid that, you know, her entire thing is trying to disguise that she has this weird voice, and she decides that, no, I'm going to go out and make a speech. And you're just like, you are such an idiot.
Yeah. And, you know, before I even say it, you say, yep, let her do it.
Yep, she's right. It's her turn. Yep. Go for it. Oh, man. It's just, I was just pleasantly enjoying it. I think every bit of it. This without getting too far spoilery. Shall we? Let's see. I think I've more or less. Yeah, see, I do like. It's kind of, you know, very standard business, but I like the way that the plot kind of deals with changing their movie into a musical and switching from the dueling cavalier to the dancing or the whatever cavalier. And as you said, the way Cosmo again just steals all that when he's like, remind me to give you a raise, GRF. Hey, could you give me a raise?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. It's like, yeah, I love it.
Thank goodness we found you. We'd be looking at every cake in town.
That was my favourite line.
Oh, well, at least we've, you know, quid pro quo kind of thing.
Yeah, we've covered that, I guess. So, yeah. And no, I love it. And I love that, I mean, again, it's cheesy, but I love that it ends exactly as you would hope, where, you know, the bad girl gets her comeuppance and Debbie Reynolds gets her credit. And then she gets to be the star alongside Gene Kelly. And they look at the billboard and it's like, oh.
Yeah. And I like that because I think in another musical, it would outstay its welcome. At that point, once they saw the billboard, you would have another song and maybe another kind of little ending. And it didn't need it. It was written perfectly so that when you got that billboard, done.
It was the perfect out, just the billboard, one last kind of singing and dancing in the rain, and we're out.
Yeah. Just, yeah.
Yes, love it. Absolutely love it. So, do you have anything else on the writing and the plot that you wanted to bring up before I move to acting?
No, that's pretty much everything I've got, mate.
Cool. Well, I'll just start off with a little tiny bit of information that I have about, as I said, the actual the actors themselves. Debbie Reynolds, as you know, is in this movie and was not a dancer when she made Singing in the Rain. Her background was actually as a gymnast. Kelly apparently insulted her for lacking dance experience, which upset her. Later, when Fred Astaire was in the studio, he found Reynolds crying under a piano. On hearing what had happened, Astaire volunteered to help her with her dancing. Kelly later admitted that he'd not been kind to Reynolds and was surprised that she was still willing to talk to him afterwards. After shooting the Good Morning routine, which had taken from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. to shoot, Reynolds' feet were bleeding. Years later, she said, quote, Singing in the Rain and childbirth were the two hardest things I ever had to do in my life. So, yeah. And just in case any fellow nerds out there aren't aware, Debbie Reynolds is, of course, famous for being the mother of DK.
Carrie Fisher.
Yes, Princess Leia herself. Being a badass just clearly runs in that family. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of all I had in terms of, like, little bits about the acting, like I said. Gene Kelly, not the nicest, but not, I mean, not. I've seen a lot worse, and like you said, at least he acknowledged since I'm surprised we're still friends, I apologize, etc. And it's kind of nice to hear about Fred Astaire helping out, I guess.
Legend.
Yeah.
What a nice guy. I mean, I can't hate Gene Kelly because he's just awesome. I think he is. I mean, when you look at him, the guy was just talent personified when he came.
Oh, there's undeniable talent, 100%. Yeah.
And I think he was just, when you're at that level, you expect everybody else to be able to pick it up with you. And I think he was just a perfectionist, and maybe the frustration, you know, got to him and that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
it is what it is.
I mean, I did make a note, and this is a little embarrassing, perhaps, for me, but I made a note that, like, even though I'm sitting watching this, as I said, on 4K at home, alone, on my couch, at the end of most of the kind of song and dance and tap routines and whatever else, I genuinely had to applaud, because I'm just like, whoa, well done, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody else can see me, but I'm just like, that deserves something.
There are scenes, and obviously, I mean, you go into this knowing some of the background. You knew about the Debbie Reynolds and her bleeding feet and stuff like that. But you see them during the... Did you not? I thought
no,
that was pretty
I,
much
I knew
knowledge.
Nothing about this film until like a week ago.
Yeah, there's that section where Kelly takes Debbie into that studio and puts the sunset up, and she's dancing around, and yeah, I was watching it with someone else, and you say it's hard to believe as you're watching her that she's counting her steps as she's doing it because she was, you know, having that harder time doing it. They make it look effortless. And when you get a little further into the film and they're doing the good morning routine and all three of them are side by side on the steps, up and down the steps, you just, again, you can't help but want to applaud them because you just think, my goodness, this is something.
That was brilliant. Just so well done. You know what I mean? And yeah, it's you just find yourself thinking, I was thoroughly entertained and I recognize talent when I see it. And yeah, we don't really have a lot of that, especially somebody that can do everything, you know, acting, singing, dancing at that level. And yeah, I mean, I will say, even though she's got no business being in the film, even like Sid Charisse, her dance with Gene Kelly, outstanding to watch. No business being in the movie,
I'll come to it. That entire sequence is the one thing that I think maybe drags a little.
It drags more than a little. It was the thing that I kind of found, and I was like, this is self-indulgent. This is Gene Kelly, you know, I'm going to do this for as long as it takes to showcase myself. And I said, there's no, like, why Sid Charisse appearing out of nowhere? It's not even Debbie Reynolds that's there doing it with him. And it's fantastic to watch, but it just feels like it's been pulled out of another show or another movie and just bonked in.
That's the thing. That's the scene that made me think this could have come from another musical, one of the lesser musicals, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely.
I get where he would, you know, I get that the message it was trying to convey about this, you know, this hick dancer that came in and eventually it went to his head and he forgot his origins and stuff. I get it. Fine. I get why they wanted to put it in the movie. But I think, A, it could have been shorter. And B, it could have maybe been included in the film in a more natural way, other than Gene Kelly says, oh, yeah, we could have this scene. It could go something like this. And then having what in essence is almost like a kind of dream sequence. And it just, to me, it just drags on a little too much. And at that point, you just think, I want to get back to Cosmo. And, you know,
that was exactly my note. I put, like, it stops the movie dead because it isn't related to the actual thing that you're watching. So, like I said, I mean, yeah, fair enough. It's entertaining enough in its own, and you can watch it and be like, what a great little performance. But it's not connected. It's the only thing that's not connected story-wise to anything else in the movie, other than the very vague, like, and this is what's going to be on the movie screen that we're showing. So it doesn't connect to those characters in any way that's meaningful, and you're just like, yeah, this is great, but it's flat because it's got nothing to do with what I've been watching. And like I said, you just think, well, can we get back to seeing what, you know, Cosmo and what Kathy are up to? I want to know what's going on. And like I said, when it first happened, I was so confused at what was going on because I didn't realize, you know, the fact that it's completely different people, but it's still Gene Kelly, even though it's supposed to be, you know, the lead actor of the film or whatever. And I'm just like, what am I seeing here? Is this reality? Is it a dream? Is it? And then it wasn't until the very end that I was like, oh, he's describing what he wants to put into the laughing or whatever, the Dancing Cavalier movie. I see now, I understand. But again, it doesn't make any sense because where was Lena Lamont in that case? You know what I mean? Where was any of the things? And I mean, you'd already stretched credulity with the whole, we're going to do a narrative.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Where dreams happen in the past and the modern stuff is real, but this seems like a weird pseudo dream sequence itself. It's just, it's messy. And
it is.
Yeah.
I think, anyway. I mean, obviously Kelly wanted to he wanted a little showcase for his talents. They'd already done that previously with the actual Singing in the Rain bit. But when you compare that, which was so natural, to this, and to me, this seemed a little forced. It would have been, and I'm sure people listening are going to go, what do you know? You're not a director. You know, let's see you make a movie. But I think if instead of being in RF's office, if maybe they would have been on a soundstage, and Kelly said, oh, I imagined it something like this, and then going into it, I think it would have seemed, a little less forced. And if they did just... And, you know, no offence to Sid Charisse. She's brilliant at what she did, but there was no real need. I mean, you know, did they find her out back on that day, smoking a cig or something? Just maybe cut the sequence down a bit. You know?
Just... They wouldn't have found her outside smoking a ciggy, because I did read that she said that she had to get taught how to smoke to do that scene in the movie, and it was the first and last cigarette she ever had.
Oh, God. Oh, well.
Candy
cigarette, then. I don't know. If they'd have just made it fit into the narrative more naturally, and if they'd have just shortened it a little, I still think you could have highlighted Gene's talents. I still think you could have conveyed that little message about, you know, the dancer coming to the big city and making it and being reminded of his roots. I just think it could have been done a little better. I think it's perfect. But that just kind of, it's just like a thorn in my paw, if you know what I mean.
I feel like it would aid the movie and be almost a more perfect movie if you just cut that scene completely, because you don't need it, you don't need to see it. And this is what I was thinking of putting in the movie within a movie here, because it doesn't connect to anything. And like I said, it feels to me like it's very just Gene Kelly being self-indulgent. I want a moment for just me. I want to be with the biggest dancer in the world and singing, even though she's not in this movie. We're going to get her in and I'm going to show that I can keep up with her and whatever. And it's just like, there's no purpose. And you've already done, like you said, kind of, or like you alluded to, he's had moments like that in the film already, like the Moses Supposer sequence where he's doing it with Donald O'Connor, or the whole dance when he's basically like seducing Kathy on the film set. He's got tons of like dance and tap routines. And even if he wants one of his own, he's got the Singing in the Rain routine, which is frankly much better and more iconic and simpler than all of this. You know, he does all this extravagant Broadway review type stuff. And yet the thing that everyone remembers from the movie is the Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain. I mean, you could have had a sequence with him doing all the kind of moves and got rid of the extraneous, you know, mafia type deal going on. And I think it would have served his performance a lot better. There is a certain dance movie does in that section where he spins around and around, and it literally, you just think, my God, that man could dance. He's just breathtaking. But you could have put that in a shorter scene, and it would have still highlighted him, and you didn't need all that extra stuff.
I mean, we're criticizing a classic, and it doesn't detract hugely from the film. But part of me wonders if you could just have done it as a like an opening act before the movie even starts. Just like, you know, Gene Kelly doing what Gene Kelly does, enjoy this performance, then we'll start the movie. In the way that he used to have like a cartoon before a B-movie or whatever, you know?
You could have, but again, I think the start of the movie is perfect. And to be honest, if I'd have seen that before the movie, I would have probably tuned out before the movie even started.
See, I'd have been hooked in, because I'd have been like, well, this guy's clearly got talent. Let's see what he's actually going to bring to the narrative of the movie. I was entertained. Because like I said, it wasn't that I wasn't entertained during that sequence. I was just like, I want to be in the movie. This is, it's stopping the flow completely dead. Yeah. It's out of nowhere. And it's just, like you said, it also just goes on too long. It could have easily been at least half the length.
Yeah, exactly. So,
anyway, like I said, we're nitpicking a classic, and I'm sure some people will be... you know, calling us Philistines.
I'm sure they will, and they have every right to. But you know, you've seen, this is the first time you've seen it. This is the first time I've seen it in 40 years, maybe. When you have two people that see it, relatively speaking, for the first time, and they both notice that thing, we are not going to be the only people to notice it. And as you say, it does kind of stop it dead. So by the time, as wonderful it is as it is to watch Gene, you are wondering, what Cosmo's up to. You are wondering what Kathy's up to. It's, and you know, it's a shame. Yeah. It's a shame because and other than that, it's just a nigh on perfect film. I mean, it brings us to Gene. I mean, it's just it's incomparable. His the fact that, you know, Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds could keep up with him at all is just astonishing to me. And when you look at that, I mean, that the Moses Supposer sequence with him and Donald O'Connor, my God, that's amazing.
So it's incredible. That's what I mean. I mean, like, I don't know this because, like I said, this is the first time I've seen the movie, but I really hope Donald O'Connor got as much kudos as Gene Kelly because he's doing all of, like, he's keeping up with him in the dance routines and Moses Supposes and stuff. And he's also doing, like, really extreme physical comedy as well. And it's just like, that impressed me no end, you know what I mean? Like, not to say that Gene Kelly's not a fantastic actor and dancer and wasn't holding his own when it came to the comedy bits and pieces, but I was just like, this dude is incredible.
I don't know if this is how you feel, but Donald O'Connor is so good in this. I kind of feel guilty by thinking he's a standout because I feel a little bit bad for Gene Kelly at that point because I'm drawn to the character of Cosmo. I'm drawn to Donald O'Connor. And my thought is, I have to see more with this guy. This is the only thing I've seen him in. You know, it's my shame. But I do intend to search out more. I mean, I've looked him up since and seen what movies is it. I'm going to look him up. So I kind of feel a bit guilty for Gene Kelly because it's his vehicle, so to speak. And well, I mean, I'm punching him in the stomach, especially after our little rant about that Broadway scene.
Well, I mean, we're from a different generation and we're of a generation now where there's, you know, these people aren't going to care. There's literally only one surviving member of the cast. So, you know, we're not going to be offending anybody that that might hear this. When it comes to the songs and stuff, it allows the cream to rise to the top, so to speak. So, yes, there are some that are less kind of impressive that, you know, I could list off, but they didn't stick in the zeitgeist for whatever reason. But as I'm sitting watching it, like I said, I started to sing along with the ones I knew, and I was like, I know Make 'Em Laugh. Didn't know about the fantastic routine that accompanied it, but I knew the song, you know. So I knew that. I could sing along with that. I knew Singing in the Rain. I vaguely knew Moses Supposes, which, by the way, one of only two songs that were written for this film specifically. What else? Like, there was a few others that were iconic, like I said, that was... Good Morning, I knew, like, every word of. But, I mean, as you kind of, I think, alluded to earlier off air, that might have been because we've seen everybody from Morecambe and Wise to, you know, to whoever else perform a version of it. So,
They are so well known. But you look at this and you think, it's so well known for a reason.
Yeah, definitely. And, like I said, you just can't fault. When you know something like this, or some of the routines and some of the songs and stuff, without ever having seen the film, I think it's a testament to how much that film has affected popular culture, which, again, I'll get into a little bit more later. But, I don't have much else, like I said, on the acting. I did want to, like, we've already talked about all of the strong points, like I said. Credit to Gene Kelly, related to what you were saying. I think in a way, it's a credit to him that we say that the Donald O'Connor almost steals the film because it's also his job to make his co-stars look good. And I think he does that with, well, all three of them look good. You know, they look like they're all keeping up with each other. They're all doing a great job. And like I said, not to take anything away from Gene Kelly, perhaps the point is that you're expecting him to be great because his is the, you know, the marquee name. And so you're like, you did exactly what you were outstanding. You went above and beyond, but I expected that because it's your name there. What I didn't expect was, you know, the second and third build to be impressing me almost as much, you know.
I'll say that for Kelly. As I say, I read that Donald O'Connor and Debbie Reynolds were originally all supposed to be in the Singing in the Rain number, but he rearranged it so it was just him. That aside, you're used to, you know, when someone is the leading man, especially in that era, you expect them to have all the glory moments for themselves. And he doesn't do that. As you say, he gives it to O'Connor, he gives it to Reynolds. And as a result, this movie just comes out really strong for all three main players. And I think that's a testament to Gene Kelly. He wasn't like a spotlight hog, as it were, in this.
No. And like you said, it's not just that. It's a question of if there was like difficulty and they weren't getting on really well and they were really struggling and to keep up, you know, Debbie Reynolds had bleeding feet and maybe what they weren't getting on with each other. Maybe there was, I don't know, some resentment between Kelly and O'Connor. If that was the case, there's no trace of that on screen. Like no. You said, you watch something like the Good Morning sequence and I just feel like these three are the best of friends you will ever see. They're in sync so perfectly. If anything did happen off, you know, off stage, so to speak, they left it off stage because, just my God, it was incredible to watch. You know?
And I have to say, it was so easy to fall in love with Debbie Reynolds during this movie.
Yeah. I mean,
God, she's just amazing. I just love her in this. When you put it on and you just think instantly, yeah, that's a leading lady.
I will say, though, related to that, though, although I didn't really find myself falling in love with the character on a personal level, I found it thoroughly believable, her relationship with, you know, with Gene Kelly. And I found the fact that he fell in love with her and vice versa believable, which, again, is really hard to pull off. Sometimes if you've seen some rom-coms, you know, even from the modern age, where these actors just do not have chemistry. But this, like I said, not only are they keeping up with physical performances and routines and stuff, they also have chemistry. Not even just the love relationship, the friendship between between Don and Cosmo is felt from the very start. And all you get is like it's his faithful friend, been there since he was young, and he's standing. And again, credit where it's due, O'Connor's standing off to the side in the background in that opening sequence while Kelly's doing all the narrating. So The only other note I have about the acting, and I wanted to shout it out because I laughed so hard and it was so dumb. At the very start of the movie, when they're introducing everybody to the, whatever it is, the film premiere or what have you, and Zelda is introduced, and there's just one really enthusiastic extra or supporting artist who just jumps up and goes, "Woo, Zelda!"
I didn't pick up on that one.
What was that? It's right in your face. I can't believe you didn't. And I was laughing for a solid, like, 2 minutes after that. It was just like, they kept that in the film.
There is, I think, one scene later, and it's in that, like, you know, section that neither of us are keen on. It's where they're unveiling the outfits, as if in Star Windows, and the women come down the steps, and I think one of them trips a little.
Mm. Okay, fair enough. But no, I mean, so I take it that's all we really have said as much as we need to. I think on the acting, everybody's great in this, effectively. So.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to move to the directing because there's a few things I wanted to shout out because I will say, for all that we've praised every other aspect, I do think there's fantastic directing here. We've dealt with the part of it that I'm assuming was the purview of Gene Kelly, the choreography, which again, just to emphasize, outstanding. Pretty, you know, perfect, can't fault it and recognize how difficult that is. But just on a, you know, film nerd directing level, there were so many things I noticed as well that I wanted to shout out. So the first one is the use of color in all of this, I think it's so, for want of a better word, it's so aesthetically pleasing. I was just like, they use so many bright colors and Technicolor and stuff in an era when it had only just really kind of come around. You know, it's 1952, did you say? So it's not like color films were, you know, the norm even necessarily at this point. And it's bright and it's vibrant and it's fun to watch and it makes the most of the costumes. You know, I can see how Debbie Reynolds kept a lot of them. And I can't remember if it's this sequence, but I've written like, I've got a feeling you're fooling, is a montage that's just gorgeously trippy. And it has these great transitions of just like random women in costumes that it just transitions to, you know, them standing, showing off. Almost like a fashion show type thing. And I'm just like, this is brilliant. It goes with the music. It's gorgeous to watch the attractive people, obviously, but also in stunning clothes that are brightly colored that draw your attention. They're all a bit different and unique. And I was just like, this is, again, maybe it's the choreography. Maybe it's the way the director did it. It certainly is in terms of the transition between them. The fact that it's just like, it's solid. It's a sort of smooth dissolve, no jerkiness, no, you know, I will swing the camera and then swing it back or whatever. It's just like one woman's there, then the next is there, then the next is there. And it's just like,
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I loved that sequence. Was the beautiful girl sequence specifically. Was that one. But I did like the kind of montage sequence on Feeling You're Fooling as well. The staging I think is great. And I think that you've already mentioned it, but the way that Gene Kelly, within the narrative, organizes the studio. So, you know, he's like, have a breeze, have the moonlight, have a little mist. And it's showing you all the tricks of like, this is how they do it, and it's completely fake, but the performance sells it as real anyway, even in the face of, like, this is the fakeness of it, which, again, is such a brave thing for any film to do. I love the way that she... And again, in terms of, you know, it being easy to fall in love with Debbie Reynolds, the way she's in soft focus and she kind of, you know, the fan's just blowing her hair and she stood at the top of the ladder that's mimicking a balcony, I'm just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's the... I fell in love with her sequence right there, really, isn't it, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, I'm going to digress here a little. When I joined this, you're running a show called The Silver Screen. Nothing to me epitomizes the glamour about Hollywood more than something like this.
I know agreed,
we kind of touch upon it when we did things like Casablanca, because it's such an iconic part of cinema history. But when you watch a film like this, and yes, it could all be propaganda, but I think this is what it's this kind of thing that people see, especially, I mean, not necessarily our generation, but the generation before, and they look at and they think why people fall in love with Hollywood. It's that kind of image that it portrays, and it's that kind of, you know, the iconic imagery of it all, the feeling, the atmosphere, that actually labels it the silver screen. So nothing says to me more about that kind of... I mean, you know, I discussed some really... Let's be fair. Some not very well-liked ones on my show.
And on the cult classics,
yeah. And on Silver Screen Regular, yeah, we look at modern stuff for the most part, and it's good. Good films. But when you come to this... you recognize a true classic and you just think this epitomizes Hollywood for me. And I think this is where a lot of love for the town and a lot of love for the business of show comes from.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree. And yeah, like you said, it's something we've lost because of, you know, and it's weird how it is. It's that golden age of movies commenting on an even more golden age that came before it. And maybe we always do that. It's just nostalgia, like you said, looking back. But it does seem like it's from an age where we had movie stars in big quotes that we just don't really have nowadays, because the paparazzi are constantly in their face, so we see every aspect of their private life. Maybe because people just don't have that level of investment or talent or charisma or dedication anymore, unless of course you're Tom Cruise throwing himself off buildings and stuff to desperately show the best done. But it's great, and it's again another of the reasons I wanted to watch things like this and to start the cinema classic show, is because, as you said, things from around that era do hit different. They are just like, they're classic, and they you can't really make them quite the same, which is why, again, I like Babylon, because it harkens back to a time when they were making those kinds of films, even though it's not that kind of film itself.
I think we've got to a point now where with modern movie making, especially, that by the time a movie is released, you know so much about it through trailers and social media and you know, news articles. And to some extent, by the time a movie comes out, unless you're really looking for it, you're sick of hearing about it. Yeah. And I think this era, that, you know, especially what we're looking at, there's so much mystery. So, like, the, you know, it's got that glamour about it. It's, and I'm sure dreadful things went on just as they do any other time. You know, I'm sure people were getting screwed over by studios and, you know, you hear stuff. But there's an appeal to it because I think you have that kind of, that glitz, that glamour.
And I think it's also, to a degree, again, not to sound really, you know, you're old and out of touch, but it's, to a degree, when you watch these older movies, part of the enjoyment with me is that it feels way more like magical and otherworldly in the regard, like, all movies, you know, take you, suck you in and captivate you, and, you know, you're transported to another world for a little while, especially the movies that I like, which tend to be sci-fi, fantasy, horror, you know, things that aren't very real. But there's something, maybe because we're even more divorced from them in time, maybe it's because of the way they were made, maybe it's the heightened reality of it all, but there's something about watching an older movie from, like, the 40s, 50s especially, that you're just like, this really is like being transported into another world, and it's pure magic. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I'm not no prude, but I think another good thing about this is you can watch these kind of movies, and you could, you know, why I ended up watching it when I was 4 or 5 years old. Someone can stick it on the TV, the entire family can watch it, you're not worrying about something that might be, you know, inappropriate. Yeah. And I just think it worked. As you say, there is that magic to it. I mean, that obviously cinema wasn't as advanced back then, but as well as the glitz and the glamour, you had to have damn good writing and damn good performances. It wasn't, you know, people weren't just going to rely on VFX, as it were.
I'd be fascinated to know, and if you are of a younger generation and you do decide to watch this, or you happen to have seen this and you're a fan of this, I'd love to hear from you, because, I mean, is it just that it hits us because it's nostalgia for a time that we can still just about remember, or is it actually as good as we think it is, you know? So, yeah, anyway. I don't want to beat the dead horse about the direction, but yeah, I love all the transitions, love the way that it's filmed. I think you credit where it's due to Stanley Donen as well as Gene Kelly. So did you have anything else, or shall I have a little bit about the production design generally, unless you wanted to say something else?
No, that's it. I just think it's extremely competently directed, and when someone says Gene Kelly, you don't automatically, I never guessed until this, about directing. So, I mean, obviously he wasn't directing alone, but
yeah,
so
I assume that's, I mean, I know nothing about this, but I assume that's kind of a throw him a bone type credit for the fact that he would have been responsible for all of the choreography when it comes to dance sequences and stuff. So the director literally is just pointing it at him and, you know, camera shooting, off you go. So he is like directing in that sense. I don't believe he would have been doing like the movie, you know, camera directing, camera tricks, or whatever that we think of as directing, you know. Again, I could be wrong about that, but it seems to me like that's probably where they were going with the co-directing credit.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt. You were saying, sorry.
No, that's it. I just think it's extremely competently done. There's never a point where the action lulls, that scene that drags on a bit, but there's never a point where you just think, oh, that's not done very well, or that's every angle in this, every shot, and even when you're looking at the direction of the film itself, looking within a film, it's done really well. It's just done really well.
I mean, I think even, like I said, it's the first time I've ever watched it. I've only watched it once. I think knowing that scene's coming now, I probably wouldn't mind it as much anyway, and I could appreciate it for all of, because it is, it does wow you. You know what I mean? It's just that I was so confused and like, oh, it shouldn't really belong in this part of the film. But I will say, credit where it's due, it's also the bloody sexiest part of the film as well.
I don't, you know, I can't deny that. I could have just, the dancing, fine, just like I said, done without the kind of semi-narrative that we're going on about, you know, the guys flipping coins and stuff.
Just in regards to kind of, I think it comes under production design, but I just wanted to sort of let you know about this, the costumes and things of the movie, because I found this really fascinating. Costume designer Walter Plunkett said that this was the most work he ever did on a film, including Gone with the Wind back in 1939. Both films were period pieces, but this one required a greater number of elaborate, ornately detailed costumes than Gone with the Wind did. I would say that's, you know, you can see that. They had to be more accurate as well, since 1952 audiences remembered Hollywood of the late 20s more clearly than 1939 audiences remembered the Civil War. Yeah, that figures.
All told,
Plunkett designed about 500 costumes. The film rang up a final price tag of $2,540,800, $157,000 of which went to Walter Plunkett's costumes alone. Although the final price overshot MGM's budget by $665,000, the studio quickly realized the wisdom of its investment when the film returned a $7.7 million profit on its initial release.
Nice. So,
yeah, I mean, speaks for itself. Look at that level of profit in 52. Just insane. And yeah, like I said, we've said it already, but the costuming, the staging, the way everything's set up, the use of color, the use of you know, light and shadow when it's needed, just so good. Just a beauty to watch, you know.
It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful flick.
Yeah, cool. So I do have... are you happy for us to move on to the music and sound part?
Yeah.
You've kind of already... Well, I don't know if that's... I'll mention it, because you've kind of mentioned, obviously, this started off as, you know, the songs come from other places and they were put together into the narrative to form Singing in the Rain, which, again, fascinates me, because it doesn't feel as hodgepodge as all that when you're watching it. But, yeah, apparently this was common in Hollywood movies, so many of the songs had been used in previous films. Quite a few of the ones in Singing in the Rain can be heard in the Broadway Melody of 1936, such as I've Got a Feeling, You're Fooling, You Are My Shining Star, Broadway Rhythm, Broadway Melody, and All I Do Is Dream of You. The title song, Singing in the Rain, actually made its debut in the Hollywood Review of 1929. Only two songs were entirely written for this film, Moses Supposes and Make 'Em Laugh. Two great songs, though, to be fair. This was the seventh time the song Singing in the Rain was used on the big screen. It was introduced, as I said, in the Hollywood Review of 29, where it was sung twice, first by Cliff Edwards and Brock's sisters, then by the MGM roster in front of a Noah's Ark backdrop. A clip from Edwards' footage was later used as part of the talkie montage in Babes in Arms in 1939. Jimmy Durante sang it briefly in Speak Easily, 1932. In The Old Dark House, also in 1932, Melvin Douglas enters, singing this song somewhat inebriated. Judy Garland put her spin on it in Little Nellie Kelly in 1940, and the song was also featured as an elaborate musical sequence performed by William Bendix and cast in The Babe Ruth Story in 1948. But again, I think it's very telling that out of all of those, the one that we know is only this... the Gene Kelly version.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All of that competition, and this still stands out as iconic. So, yeah,
it is. I do have one fact that I forgot to say when we're doing performances. With regards to the movies that I was looking up for Donald O'Connor, I did find out that he was originally supposed to be in White Christmas with Bing Crosby, and he got kind of, I'm not going to say typecast, but he ended up doing a lot of Francis the Talking Mule movies. And he ended up catching a bug from the mule, which put him out of action, and so had to be replaced on White Christmas by Danny Kaye. And apparently he wasn't incredibly happy about that, which, in all fairness, I can understand. So
yeah, definitely. That's a shame. Yeah, I think it's a shame that I feel bad that I'd never heard of him until seeing this. And like you, I'm kind of like, I wish he'd had a better career, and I want to go back and look at the stuff he has done, because he really impressed me. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, with regards to the music, I don't want to sit and list all of the music in the movie. It's, you know, if you know it, you know it. If you don't, then go and watch the movie and enjoy it and find out, you know, for yourself which of them you prefer. But I do have to ask, just because I thought, you know, why not ask this and put ourselves on the spot even more? Do you have a particular favourite musical number, DK, from the film?
That's a very tricky one. There's so many good ones in this.
I know, it's really difficult.
I'm gonna have to go with Good Morning. Simply because it's got all three of them, and
yeah,
it just works so well. It works so well with all three of them.
I think I agree, because I'm thinking of, like, by musical number, I mean, like, the song Divorced from the performance.
In that case, I think it's still going to be Good Morning.
And I think the same, like I said, because if you add performance to it, it's going to be different. But I've actually said that as my favourite scene slash moment later. So I'll bring it up then.
So have I.
So yeah, I'll bring that up later on, which I haven't mentioned yet. But I think if you're just going off musical in terms of, you know, you put the soundtrack on, which one would you skip to kind of have a good time? And again, there's a lot of them. I could easily do that with Moses, with, you know, Singing in the Rain itself, with Make 'Em Laugh. But I think the one I would go to would be, as a song, would be Good Morning. And yeah, just it's just so feel good.
You know? It is. It's a happy song. I say that there's a lot of them in this. But yeah, it really shines through.
Awesome. So we've kind of talked long enough, I think. We don't want this episode to be too long. So we're going to move on to our next section, which on our other versions of the podcast, whether it be Silver Screen or Cult Classics, we normally ask the audience for their response. But when it comes to cinema classics, I kind of always assume that, you know, we're going to look at movies that are quite well regarded. So instead of asking the audience, why not look at the way critics responded to these movies? So I have given DK the critics' response to this. And DK, I'm going to throw it to you. What did the critics make of...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, no worries. Pauline Kael, the longtime film critic for The New Yorker, said of the film, "This exuberant and malicious satire of Hollywood in the late 20s is perhaps the most enjoyable of movie musicals, just about the best Hollywood musical of all time." Roger Ebert placed Singing in the Rain on his Great Movies list, calling the film a transcendent experience, and no one who loves movies can afford to miss it. I will agree with that. On review aggregator Rotten Tomatoes, the film has a perfect 100% approval rating based on 64 reviews. That is good. With an average rating of 9.3 out of 10. The website's critical consensus reads, "Clever, incisive and funny, Singing in the Rain is a masterpiece of the classical Hollywood musical." On Metacritic, the film has a weighted average score of 99 out of 100 based on 17 critics, indicating universal acclaim. The film made each site's list of best rated films, ranked 46th on Rotten Tomatoes, that's as of 2021, and 9th on Metacritic.
Yeah, so that's kind of what the critics thought of it. We've mentioned a little bit of the in the behind the scenes and a lot of it there as well. But I also wanted to deal with, I think this is one of the films that, as I've mentioned earlier, has pervaded popular culture in such a huge way. And as I was kind of doing my research, I made a note of not all, but certainly a huge chunk of the way that the film has influenced popular culture and where you might can you know, see snippets of it or where it's made an impact. And I just wanted to go over some of that, if I may. So maybe something here will fascinate you, maybe not. Anyway, Gene Kelly's hometown Pittsburgh Pirates games at PNC Park play the scene from the film during rain delays, meaning the Singing in the Rain sequence, I assume. In 1971, Stanley Kubrick's film A Clockwork Orange has Alex Malcolm McDowell singing in the rain during the home invasion and assault scene, and later while he's taking a bath.
Not a very good scene to remember.
No, it's very counter to what the initial intention was, I think, of the film. So, yeah, not, if you are going to watch that one, be warned, perhaps. You've already mentioned this, but in their 1976 Christmas special, the British comedy act Morecambe and Wise parodied the Singing in the Rain sequence. From 1979 in Alien, Sigourney Weaver's main character Ellen Ripley quietly sings parts of You Are My Lucky Star to herself while hiding from and preparing to fight the eponymous antagonist. I had no idea about that.
I didn't. Jeez.
In 2005, leaping ahead a bit, the dance to the title song is parodied in the Monty Python Broadway musical Spamalot in the dance break to Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, complete with tap dancing knights spinning bright yellow umbrellas around.
Holy crap. I went to see that and I've just remembered that.
I've never seen it, but I'm just like, I love the sound of that.
I saw it when it kicked off in the West End with Tim Curry as Arthur. And yes, Really good. Really good.
Brilliant. Oh, brilliant. I love it. Also in 2005, and again, we mentioned this off air, the Singing in the Rain sequence was featured in a Volkswagen Golf commercial with Gene Kelly seen breakdancing in the street, thanks to, I assume, some kind of AI manipulation. Also featured was Mint Royale's version of the song accompanying the commercial, which, as we've said, is a surprising banger.
It is. That was, as I said to you off air before we started, that was on repeat constantly on my player.
Awesome. In 2010, two songs of the film were featured in The Substitute, a season 2 episode of the TV series Glee. In 2012, in the film Silver Linings Playbook, Jennifer Lawrence's character is inspired by a clip of Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly dancing to Moses Supposes. In 2013, the anime short Gisoku no Moses features a young female ghost dancing with a pair of haunted dance shoes to the tune of Moses Supposes, which I wasn't going to include, but it's here for Toby, because you probably would have seen this anime, I'm guessing, and because that sounds incredible.
It does. I want to see that now.
Dancing with haunted dance shoes? What the heck, man? Anyway, in 2015, in the romantic drama film Brooklyn, Tony Fiorello, Emery Cohen, takes Ellis Lacey, Saoirse Ronan, out on a date to see the film. In the next scene, he emulates Gene Kelly's iconic swing on the lamppost. In 2017, you'll appreciate this, the song Good Morning was featured in the Legends of Tomorrow Season 3 episode Phone Home. So, yeah, quite an impact. That's only a small thing. I think maybe a quarter of the actual things I could have listed, but I didn't want to go on for too long. So, with all of that out of the way then, that brings us to the part where we have to name our favourite character moment and repeat our favourite line, because we've already said them. So, first of all, I think I know how this is going to go as well, potentially, but I'm going to ask you first, DK, who was your favourite character in the movie and why?
Well, it's got to be Cosmo, isn't it?
Dude, you were going to say that.
Yeah, dude, to me...
Now, I feel bad for Gene Kelly.
I feel, oh, don't make me feel any more guilty. Yeah, he literally steals every scene he's in, and that's not to disparage the talents of Kelly or Reynolds. It's just, he's such a great character for the audience to latch on to, and his timing is impeccable.
Yeah. It's weird how I've written, I'm going to read my note ad nauseum, because I've said almost exactly word for word what you've said. I said my favourite character is Cosmo. He kind of steals the film for me. Not that the others are bad, but he gets the best lines, funniest moments, and has to perform both straight and comedic sequences. Also, I can just relate to being a third wheel.
Yes.
So what was your favourite sort of moment or scene in the movie then?
It's... We mentioned it slightly earlier. It's got to be the Good Morning sequence.
Oh, okay, brilliant.
All three of them at the top of the game. They're all playing off each other, and it just works. It's just beautiful.
Yeah. And mine, again, probably not be a surprise the way I've talked about it, but mine is the entire Make 'em Laugh sequence. I was stunned by it, and I could watch that in isolation time and time again, I think, and never get bored, and just be wowed by the physical comedy and the humour, and I just like, this is brilliant. How have I never seen this before? You know? Yeah, I loved it. And so, yeah, I think we've probably already mentioned these, but favourite lines, why not repeat them? What was your favourite line?
I can't understand it. This car hasn't given me a lick of trouble in nearly 6 hours.
And mine, of course, was, gee, I'm glad you turned up. We've been looking inside every cake in town. Both Cosmo lines, just say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, then in that case, just to wrap us up, we just have to give our, as we always do, our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars for Singing in the Rain. Would you rather go first, or would you like me to?
I'll go first, but I get the feeling I'm going to be hated for it.
Well, we'll see.
All right. Despite evidence to the contrary, I'm not a musicals person, especially from what they turned the golden era. But seriously, in all honesty, it's just a delight from beginning to end. The main players are personable and dearable. The script is still funny even now. The story moves along at a pace it's over with before you know it. You know, with the only exception being the one that we've mentioned. The songs have been overused in, well, pretty much everything at one point or another, but they still feel as fresh and catchy as can be. I'm sure there'll be more musicals on this show, ones I may or may not be here for, but this one I'm glad was the first to be reviewed. And at the risk of being awkward, I'm going to give this one a 4.8.
Okay. That's fair enough. Yeah. I think I just forgot that we could, you know, we could do bits in between. But anyway,
I couldn't legitimately give it five. As perfect as I think it is, that sequence dragged on too much. But I didn't want to go as low as 4.5. So I thought, well, other people get away with it, so screw it.
I should have thought of that, but I'm going to stick with what I have, you know, and I'll read it again. Sorry if there's some repeating of what I've said in the episode in my conclusion, and don't hate me when I give my final score. So I said, well, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I'm glad I've plugged that gap in my film education, and I would definitely watch it again. The showmanship, directorial touches, staging, choreography, and just plain entertainment value were flawless. I enjoyed all the performances of the acting. They may be a little heightened for some, but I think they perfectly fit the time this was made and the picture that it is. It's also unexpectedly really funny. There are solid gags here, wit, charisma, and physical comedy that I found just joyful to watch. It's a visual treat with gorgeous use of colour and all the props, stages, and direction Hollywood could offer. The music is fantastic, though some songs are less iconic than others. Whilst I'm being hypercritical, I also felt the whole Broadway melody sequence was overly self-indulgent, unnecessary, went too long and stopped the film dead. It's undeniably impressively staged and performed, but it feels ironically like it belongs in a different film. That said, I can't really fault much else. I had a great time. I laughed a fair bit. I sang along to the numbers that I knew, even without having seen the film. I was impressed, entertained, and charmed. And I gave it 4.5 out of 5, because, like I said, I forgot that we could perhaps go in between. So, yeah, we'll add those scores together and share by 2 to give us our final score then. So, I mean, still pretty impressive with the final score from Cinema Classics for Singing in the Rain of 4.65 out of 5. So, I mean, come on.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah, 4.65 out of 5. It says a lot, really, I think. And I think that will still place it maybe second on the leaderboard up to now on the Cinema Classics. So, good film. I thoroughly recommend it. I'd love to hear, like I said, what other people, perhaps from other generations and stuff, make of it. And yeah, awesome. So I'm glad you enjoyed it as well. I didn't realise, when you said you'd seen it before, I didn't realise it hadn't been for about 40 years.
Oh, yeah, it's a long time ago. I'll be completely honest with you. For you listening out there, I messaged Mike a couple of days ago saying, you know, and asked him, he said he'd watched it. And I said, what did you think? And he said, I'll let you know on the recording. And I was like, oh, that doesn't sound good.
So I just didn't want to spoil it because I wanted you to be as fresh for you as, you know.
I was honestly thinking, oh, I bet he hates it. But how could you? How could you, really? It's just a fantastic
You know me
film.
At all.
Yeah.
It's a movie musical about making movies. Like I said, as soon as I read the description, I was just like, why have I not seen this movie? It's like it was made for me.
I'll be completely honest. I own this on digital.
Okay.
I got it, for my significant other who loves this film. Absolutely loves this film.
She has taste.
And so when she saw that it was on sale, she'd get it. So, yeah, I got it on digital. Watching this, I am now buying the Blu-ray.
I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed talking about that. And I'm glad that it's always kind of good when we both enjoy the movie, I think.
Yeah.
Even though sometimes we can have good discussions even if we don't, and it might be a bit more interesting for the audience. But I hope, like I said, that our praise maybe reaches a few ears that haven't seen this and they might try the film for themselves. So,
but you said, I mean, when it's a more modern film, like, you know, we've recently done Back to the Future and things like that, we kind of know where that's coming from. We know that we love it because we are nerds. We talk about it so frequently. When it's something like this that either one or both of us hasn't experienced in at least years, or in your case, not seen it at all, it's brilliant to talk about these things because, you know, it brings up something that we've not experienced before, and it literally is like going to the cinema and seeing something new. But because you've not, as we mentioned earlier, been force-fed information on it, it's fresh, it's new, and I love that. I loved it about Casablanca. I love it about this.
Absolutely. And I will say, kind of as I alluded to earlier, even though I've only seen this now the once, I will definitely be waiting for the next time I'm feeling a bit down on a rainy weekend or whatever and I've nothing else to do, and I'll stick this on and probably be cheered right up because it just feels like it's going to be one of those feel-good, sit and enjoy movies.
I'll be getting off this and going listening to Mint Royale again.
Awesome, awesome. Well, yeah, so I will just let you know then that there will hopefully be a graphic up on screen, as I always say now, with all the places that you can find us on the internet. We are on basically all social medias, usually under Silver Screen Podcast or my name, my variations of Michael Wilson. But you can find, if you are listening on audio, the link tree in the episode description, which will take you to all the places you can find us that way. Or as I say, if you're watching on YouTube, it'll be on screen now. You can always pause that and find us, or how to find us from there. Usually just me. I think DK is still being internet avoiding hermit. Yeah. But I will say, if you are on Facebook at all, do join our Silver Screen movie group. It's partly for the podcast, but it's also just to discuss movies in general. And we're having very, very popular best 80s movie tournament that will probably be finished by the time this goes out, but I will be starting a best 90s movie tournament soon. So if you're interested in that kind of thing and just having a bit of fun and enjoying something we love on social media instead of arguing with people about politics or whatever film directors they do or don't like, just come and join the Silver Screen movie group on Facebook, and we'd be happy to have you. Yeah, and you can even find DK in there every now and then, which is weird because he never appears anywhere on the internet.
Yeah, I am occasionally in there.
Cool. You can find me basically, you know, here. And I'll be back with more cinema classics soon. We've got a bit of a break now because we're focusing, I think, more on the Star Trek podcast, doing the second half of our Romulan-themed series, but we're back all the time. There's never too much of a gap, and I think...
You just had to bring it down, didn't you? We've had such a nice discussion, and then you bring up Romulan.
But yeah, looking here at the schedule, you will have already had a cult classics movie a week earlier or so. Next week, next Thursday, we are doing a top 10 Pixar that you can enjoy on the Silver Screen regular. And then, yeah, from July, we'll take it from there. There's a bit of a gap, but there's some big things coming up for the rest of the year as we rapidly head towards our 100th episode. Oh, boy. So, yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed this episode. And I don't remember what our next cinema classic is, but it will be in a month's time. As I say, we're sticking to one a month with the cult and the cinema classics. So just keep an eye on the social medias and on the YouTube channel and whatever else you find us. And yeah, that's a wrap on this episode of the Silver Screen Cinema Classics podcast. So remember, no matter how stormy life gets, keep singing in the rain. And until next time, good morning. Good morning. We've talked the whole night through.
Morning. Good morning to you.
Nothing could be better than to be in Louisiana.
I've a smile on my face.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material in behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.